Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Hosts Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Green Counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kettlety.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. We've got a great show today, Gene.
Yeah, we start with cooking.
We love cooking and eating, right? It's Patch to Plate with Annie, and she's going to talk about sweet potatoes and dry beans. Beans are really high in protein, and they're super nutritious and delicious.
And fun to grow. There's a billion different kinds.
Pretty easy to grow, too.
They are.
So, yeah.
And surprisingly, people don't assume offhand that sweet potatoes can be grown in this area.
And then we have an episode of It's All Greek to Me by, who would that be? Oh, that's you, Gene.
That's right.
What are you talking about today?
Different names for the plants, and some of them are descriptive, and some of them are honoraria because they want to flatter somebody.
Latin names, right?
Yeah.
It's good to use Latin names if you can, because common names are not always really helpful, right? Because there's a lot of plants that have more than one common name, or common names used for a bunch of different plants, right?
And according to the Linnaean system, which is the Latin names, it's universal. And everybody everywhere knows what that plant
right.
is.
Right, and they're descriptive, right? Many times they're descriptive as well.
They are. They can get up through all kinds of
things. So that's great. That's really helpful because I think they're difficult. And we also have an episode of Pests and Pathogens about something that we all hate, right? Emerald ash borer.
Yep. Dee Dee and Jackie go into detail on how to recognize them.
Yeah, that's important.
Because we're losing the ashes like crazy, and the real trauma there is the best baseball bats are made from ash.
That is a trauma. One of the things you really have to be careful with emerald ash borer is, first of all, safety. I have a lot of ash on my property that are just kind of falling apart now. They're a safety hazard. But also, you don't want to spread it around, so you don't really want to cut down your firewood and send it across the state or something like that. That's how a lot of it spread.
And it's a huge, huge problem.
Huge problem. Really big industry.
Well, you know what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to get me some sweet potato soup and go sit down and listen to the episode.
Sounds yummy and good to me.
Hi and welcome. We're moving today from the veggie patch to from patch to plate. We're going to talk about using home or locally grown vegetables and getting them on the table. I'm Annie Skibinski, a Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Green Counties. Today I'm thinking about winter vegetables, those readily at hand throughout the winter. I'm thinking sweet potatoes, onions, and dry beans. I've grown sweet potatoes for sure, but I've never grown beans for trying. I want to assure you that's never slowed down my prep or my enjoyment. There's lots of growing guides on our website for these and other vegetables, and I want to mention that both the sweet potatoes and the onions are grown underground. So though you can't really see what's happening, they're both good to grow in our environment. For more on growing vegetables that you can't see, check out Teresa's Veggie Patch segment in episode 38. Sweet potatoes and onions have some natural flavor affiliates. Both go great with garlic, chili peppers, nutmeg, and dairy. And when I say dairy, be it butter, creams, cheeses, both meld very, very well with these two vegetables. Even if you think about how many times you've seen a recipe that starts with saute an onion in a little butter, it's tried and true. Dried beans, when cooked, generally pair well with onions and garlic and chili peppers and, again, cheeses and spices like cumin and savory and thyme. So when you see several of these vegetables and flavor enhancers in the same recipe, you're probably looking at a recipe that's going to produce a winning result. Today, I want to talk about a preparation that you can use in a lot of different ways. So let's just get into the how we do it. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit and scrub a few sweet potatoes we're going to bake. We're only going to use one for this recipe, but I'll share ways to use another potato or two in a bit. So peel the baked potato, mash half, dice the other half. Add a diced red onion, jalapeno, and a colorful, but please not green, bell pepper, and a thumb-sized clove of garlic, finely minced. Add 2 cups of black beans. Toss it together with apple cider vinegar and some fresh lime juice. Season this with salt, pepper, cumin, thyme, and some chopped fresh herbs. The herb mix ideally should have a lot of parsley, at least half. Mix it all together and then put it in the refrigerator and chill it for several hours. To enjoy this cold, think salsa and tortilla chips. Think about putting a bowl of it on the table with other salad bar options and let people incorporate it as they see fit. Or you could even pass it as a cold side salad. I love this mixture hot. I heat it up. I add freshly cooked pasta to the sweet potatoes and beans. Toss it. Garnish it with a little more parsley. And that's a meal for me. You could also heat it, scoop it up with a slotted spoon, and lift a good scoop into a warm tortilla. Ladle the liquid into a bowl for dipping. You could add the recipe to a large frying pan or wok and heat thoroughly with cooked rice. And I will say, brown rice works really well with these flavors. If by any chance there's leftovers, heat them up and top them with fried eggs for breakfast tomorrow morning. Enjoy. So if you bake that extra sweet potato, get ready to make scones. There's no exotic ingredients involved. This is just pantry basics. Butter, sugar, salt, and an egg. Baking powder, flour, cinnamon, and some chocolate chips or chunks in addition to the mashed sweet potato. There's recipes, links, and quantities of each ingredient and directions in the show notes. These combined equal yummy scones. The scones bake in a hot oven, so start by preheating it to 425 degrees Fahrenheit. Put parchment or a silicone pad on a sheet pan, and then go through the usual steps of starting to bake. Beat your butter, sugar, and salt. Scramble in an egg. Fold in the mashed sweet potato and stir it until smooth. Mix in the baking powder and cinnamon, add in your flour, and mix until you have a kneadable dough. If it's a little wet, you can always add a tablespoon at a time of flour until you get the right consistency. Then knead in the chocolate chips and dump it out onto the counter on a lightly floured surface. Knead it 3 or 4 times and shape it into a rectangle. Roll it out to about 3/4 of an inch thickness. Use a cookie cutter roughly 2 inches in diameter and cut the dough into rounds. You can re-roll the scraps and recut them. Place each round on your prepared baking sheet. The 2-inch rounds will bake to a pretty golden brown in about 15 minutes. While it's baking, let me tell you this. It's not important that you use a 2-inch cookie cutter. You could use a glass. You could use a knife and cut it into squares. Or you can use an ice cream scoop to scoop up uniform portions. The blue ice cream scoop, by the way, measures 1/4 cup. The important thing is that the scones are of uniform size, so they all bake at the same rate. Enjoy these. Hot, cold, butter, or a little cream cheese. If you want more sweet potato recipes, Marianne Yachino has a recipe for Aunt Hildy's candied sweet potatoes in our Master Gardener cookbook. You can call the office if you'd like to buy a copy. For other recipes, please go to the nutrition page on our Cornell website. Enjoy. That's it for this edition of From Patch to Plate. I'm Annie Skibinski.
Listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for It's All Greek to Me.
Hello, Jean Thomas here again to talk about some of the language obstacles we meet. In It's All Greek to Me, I discuss some of the botanical jargon, acronyms, and Latin speak we encounter in our gardening adventures. Today, I'm going to dive into some Latin. So we're going to play with Latin plant names, named after people, mostly. People have been naming plants since Hippocrates in the 4th century BC. Egos and kissing up are eternal, I guess. As many of you may know, plants were often given names to honor someone, sometimes as a gesture of respect, and sometimes to flatter a person of power. The Christmas poinsettia is a good example. First of all, it is not a poinsettia. The plant is a native of Mexico, and when the Catholic Church established itself in Mexico, the native plant was observed to bloom at Christmas time, and it was called Noche Buena because of a legend that it changed color on Christmas Eve. The plant was discovered by Joel Poinsett while he was U.S. ambassador to Mexico. Poinsett was an avid naturalist and sent many plants back to the state for propagation. He was particularly associated with the flower called Mexican flame flower at the time. When it came time to formally assign a botanical name, the formal designation was Euphorbia pulchellima. Euphorbia, named for an ancient Greek doctor, and pulchellima, meaning beautiful. For a while, the botanical name was Euphorbia poinsettia to honor Poinsett, who had gained considerable acclaim in the scientific community for discovering the plant. Poinsett is a remarkable historical character who held many political and scientific posts, some controversial, but his immortality is because of a plant he sent home from Mexico. We've all enjoyed the cheerful yellow forsythia in the early spring. The species we know best is Forsythia X intermedia. The X in the name means that it's a hybrid, and intermedia means between types. For now, the Forsythia part of the name is what we're looking at. It's named to honor William Forsyth, 1737 to 1804. He was an English horticulturist who was royal gardener at Kensington and St. James Palaces. Here's another good one. Wisteria is named for a certain Dr. Caspar Wistar, 1761 to 1818. He was professor of anatomy at the University of Pennsylvania. Both the wisteria and the forsythia were plants named by Thomas Nuttall, 1786 to 1859, a noted English botanist. I'm not quite sure how he got to name everything, but these were the days of the plant hunters, when rich people actually financed explorations all over the world to discover new plants. And all these plants needed scientific names. We're all familiar with the gorgeous magnolia. Well, Magnolia X. Soulangeana is the big, beautiful saucer magnolia, whose genus name comes from Pierre Magnol, noted French horticulturist. The saucer magnolia is a hybrid developed by French horticulturist Soulange Boudin from two Chinese magnolias. The saucer magnolia is a hybrid developed by French horticulturist Soulange Boudin from two Chinese magnolias, hence the species, actually hybrid name, Soulangeana. While we're talking about trees and shrubs, you may have noticed some recurring names that overlap many kinds of plants. The very honored botanists C.S. Sargent, remembered by Sargenti in many genus names, Robert Fortune, Fortunae, Carl P. Thunberg, Thunbergiae, and a French missionary slash botanist slash zoologist, Father Père Armand David, Davidii, all were botanical superstars in their day and lend their names to many different plants. One last group of plants for our consideration, the herbaceous flowers. Fuchsia is a genus named for Leonard Fuchs, a botanist who lived in the 1500s and published an herbarium that was called one of the most beautiful books in the world. Now it is not only a genus of flowers, but fuchsia is the middle name of the musician Sting's daughter, in case you needed to know. Dahlia is a familiar name to gardeners. It's named for Dr. Anders Dahl, a Swedish botanist and student of Linnaeus. There are 42 species of dahlia, and the range of colors, sizes, and shapes is phenomenal. And last but not least is the lobelia. There are 415 species, including many popular perennials like cardinal flower and the great blue lobelia, Dr. Matthias de Lobile was physician to a Dutch prince and later to England's James I. He was also a noted botanist, and the great Linnaeus himself bestowed the name Lobelia on this huge genus. If you're curious about these historic characters, head for your local library and check out The Plant Hunters by Anita Silvey. I think that's enough for today. Thanks for listening to It's All Greek to Me.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for Pests and Pathogens.
Hello, and welcome back to another segment of Pests and Pathogens. We are Jackie
and Dee Dee,
and today we're going to talk about the infamous EAB, or emerald ash borer. It is a terrible invasive species that we believe to have arrived in wood pallets from Asian shippers. It was not lethal to the ash tree in its homeland because they have genetic resistance. Sadly, this is not the case in North America.
The life cycle of the emerald ash borer starts with the beetle laying its eggs between the cracks in the bark of a tree. The beetle, the scientific name Agregles plenipennis, is a beautiful emerald color, as you might assume. It's among a category of beetles called jewel beetles because of their beautiful gem-like colors. When first noticed in New York State, DEC began monitoring the presence of the beetle. You may remember seeing the purple sticky traps hanging in trees along major highways.
But the major effort is to slow down the spread of the insects was the ban on moving firewood from place to place throughout the state. This is because the insect is smaller than a penny, 3/8 to 5/8 of an inch, and can only fly 1/2 mile from where they hatch. So the rule is to prevent humans from giving the killer a ride on a whole new feeding opportunity. Once the beetles hatch, they leave a distinctive D-shaped hole in the wood of the host tree. Before the larvae hatch, the only indication of their presence is an increased woodpecker activity in search of a tasty meal. They have spent a year in the larvae, sometimes 2 years, feeding on the tree. They leave the telltale S-shaped tunnels under the bark.
Sadly, if you see these tunnels, the tree is already dead or dying. In fact, an average tree dies within 2 to 4 years of infestation. None of the four types of native ash trees have any resistance to the beetle, and the damage financially is enormous. 8% of the forest population in New York State was ash, and it was a valuable commercial resource. Total timber income in New York State averages $9 billion, so loss of one entire type of tree is a disaster. Removal of dead trees is costly, and many were grown as street trees, so the local governments have the added responsibility of maintenance and removal.
As of January 2021, the USDA determined that the eradication of the EAB is no longer feasible. The termination of this program, trying to eradicate them since 2003. The total known spread of that time included 1,198 counties, 35 states. What actions remain include continuous monitoring of the spread, treating the certain few plantations with insecticides, and continue research attempting to isolate the factors that make Asian ash tree resistant. We can still help by not moving firewood from place to place. In fact, there are still regulations in place forbidding just that. Why make a problem worse if we can avoid it?
If you have an issue with ash trees on your property, DEC strongly recommends consulting an arborist. Only inoculations of particular insecticides are effective, and even that may be too late. Do not attempt treating the trees yourself until you have consulted CCE or DEC experts. Treatment is costly and must be regulated annually, so the trees must be in good enough condition to recover and thrive. If you insist on treatment, remember to consult. Follow the label, and remember, the label is the law. Thank you for joining us. Our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org will connect you to links with more specifics. Until next time, this is Dee Dee.
And Jackie.
Thank you.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.